Back together again, you and I, kicking off a brand new week, Monday, April 25th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. I had a few thoughts on a major public prayer case that was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. And to that end, we welcomed Landmark Legal Foundation attorney Mike O'Neill to give us a wrap-up on what the court heard and to make a prediction on that case. Union organizer Daisy Pitkin dropped by to talk about her new book, On the Line, a story of class, solidarity, and two women's epic fight to build a union.
I am constantly surprised. You know, I really am. In this day and age, and this case now coming to the forefront, this, I guess, is one of those hot-button cases. But, you know, whether you're in D.C. or locally or whatever, everybody's kind of got an opinion on these cases. You know, this is what we call in the business water cooler talk. But I personally, and maybe you think I'm being flippant about this, I'm being nonsensical, I don't think so. And you can let me know at 333-9422, 333-WICC. I've never quite understood, if you will, the I don't want to say outrage, but the, well, maybe, or anger that some people have at so-called public displays of religion. Oh, geez, you're imposing a religion on me. And the federal government is showing favoritism toward Christianity and not to Judaism or Islam or whatever. And we have another one of those cases here. You may have heard about this during the day. Oral arguments held today in D.C. The U.S. Supreme Court today, this coming from the NBC News version of this story, for those of you scoring at home, seemed to incline to rule for, in other words, in favor of, for a high school football coach from Washington State who lost his job after he refused to stop praying on the field immediately after games. Now, as far as I'm concerned, kids, I don't care if a coach prays before the game, during the game, on a timeout, at halftime, at the end of the third quarter, or after the game. I don't care. I have never been so fragile in my religious convictions, of which I have many. You know, you're talking to a former altar boy here. So, you know, I was brought up in a Catholic household. I've been kind of a lapsed Catholic for a couple of years. But you know how that happens. But I've never really understood these lawsuits. I really haven't. And the fact that there are people out there, and I don't besmirch you for saying this, but I'd love to get into what's in your mind here. If you want to call me on this at 333-9422, 333-WICC. Does a public display of religion on public grounds, whether it's praying at a game, whether it's doing something on a sidewalk, you get a lot of this around the holidays with, you know, Hanukkah menorahs, Christian creches, the Islamic also symbols. There's always a cadre of people that, for some reason, gets upset about this. And I wonder why. Now, there's a fear there that, well, this is establishing a state religion, or it's showing favoritism to one religion or not. These are all these nasty right-wing Christians. I think everybody's got to pump the brake on this. Just a little bit, or the brakes. We would rather all the brakes work on the car than just the brake. Everybody needs to calm down, pump the brakes, plural, and calm down here. The coach in question here, Joe Kennedy, said the school district, or he claims, this is his suit point here, the district violated his religious freedom by telling him he could not pray so publicly after the games. But the district said it was trying to avoid the appearance that the school was endorsing a religious point of view. Now, please, who thinks, now, unless it's a Catholic school or a Christian school, if it is an openly Christian school or a school founded on the tenets of Islam or Judaism or something like that, yeah, they probably do, even though they probably, you know, invite folks of all religion there. My guess is they probably do have some sort of a religious point of view, and that's okay. They're allowed to. That's, you know, that's in the instruction manual when you get there. But really, letting this guy pray with his team, or inviting people, inviting coaches and players to take a knee and pray a little bit in the center of the field after a game, is that really a big deal? I mean, honestly, don't we have other things to worry about? And I guess this coach said nobody had ever said anything to him about it until one or two people warned him to stop. They were offended. You know, folks, let me tell you something. A lot of people get offended over nothing today. Well, it's offensive to me that somebody would pray. Now, by the way, nowhere did I see where you had to be a Christian to take a knee here. I'm sure at these schools there were athletes of, you know, different religious stripes here. Did he hold up a sign that said, Christians only? If you're a Muslim, if you're a Buddhist, if you observe Shinto, if you're of the Jewish faith, don't come out here. Jeez, I don't think so. But I've always laughed, and don't take laugh too hard, but I've always chuckled, shall I say, at some people who get mad at this stuff. Why? Why? Well, nobody should pray in public, especially after a football game. Why not? Now, if people are getting whipped that they have to go there and take a knee with this coach, okay, that's a problem. If they're being coerced to do this, that could be a problem. Now, there is a point of view that I guess some students said, well, I was feeling ostracized because, you know, if I didn't go there, my teammates were going to look at me funny. Okay, I can see that being argued. You can debate that. But it says here, back to this NBC case, Paul Clement, who's representing Kennedy, who Clement is a past a lawyer in high-ranking Republican circles. The government does not endorse all private speech just because it took place on school grounds. Interesting. One factor in the case appeared to be whether that coach's move to pray in such a prominent place on the 50-yard line amounted to a private moment of giving thanks or a public demonstration of his religious faith that his players may have felt they were compelled to join. The school district said his prayer was anything but private. He announced his plans to continue praying and invited journalists and a state legislator to watch. The district gave him a poor performance evaluation, and he did not apply to renew his football contract, his teaching contract, and coaching contract after the 2015 football season. So they had the arguments to this earlier today. We'll have analysis on this later on. But what do you think of this? Simple question here. Does this stuff ever really bother you? Honestly. Maybe we need more prayer after games. Maybe we should. Is there any? I mean, who knows? Some of these players take a knee. They may be saying, dear God, will she please say yes when I ask her out? Who knows how deeply people are praying here? But how about, is there something really wrong with that? You know, again, if he's pushing a major point of religion from his point of view, okay, you can be upset with that. But honestly, come on, folks, move on. This is just, to me, and you can disagree with me if you'd like, 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. I mean, come on. Who is sitting there in that stands? And who is on the sideline going, oh my God, I'm getting a religion endorsed toward me? Come on, please. This is all hyperpartisan, hyperbolic stuff that just is disappointing. There's no government establishment of religion here. And we all know that. So the Facebook question of the day, before we go to the break, would you be offended or angry if a coach at a public high school prayed in public with some players after the game? Right? That's it. Does this offend you? Oh, does this make you angry that a coach at a public high school prayed in public with some players after a game? Probably would help. I'm thinking it would help. First, though, one of our legal eagles, we consult with this gentleman from time to time when there's news going on, especially out of and or concerning the U.S. Supreme Court. Mike O'Neill joins us from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Check them out at landmarklegal.org. And we talk about a football coach who is in the news. Mike, it's Paul here again at WICC. Good afternoon, and how are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Good to speak with you.
Well, good to speak with you. Thanks for taking the time, Mike. We appreciate when you join us explain these things. Thank you. So the High Court today heard oral arguments, Mike, yes. in a case where you had a football coach a few years ago working as a coach under the guise of the school at a public high school. And I guess for years, this guy had been holding a post-game prayer at the center of the field, 50-yard line, center of the field for anybody who wanted to join in. And he said it was not a problem until somebody complained. Paint us the picture after that, Mike.
Sure. Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. This is arising out of Washington State. And you had an assistant coach, actually, not the head coach. And what he would do, it's actually kind of a fact-intensive analysis here. So let's state the facts right off the bat, and then we'll talk about the constitutional issues here.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So essentially what he would do was after the game would conclude, he would run out to the midfield. Again, after the game concluded, he wasn't engaging in his coaching duties. He wasn't calling plays. He wasn't substituting players in and out, all those things that a football coach does throughout the football game. After the game concluded, he ran out to the midfield, he took a knee, and he said spent about 15 seconds engaging in a silent prayer of thanksgiving to God. And that's it. That's the extent to which he did it. There was not a long prayer speech given in a post-game wrap-up and a post-game speech during the halftime speeches. We all know Friday Night Lights. We've seen the movie, seen the television show where the coach has those speeches at halftime. Didn't give a prayer during the halftime rah-rah speech. What do we have to do? Again, it was a 15-second taking a knee at midfield after the game. So what happened was he was up for – his contract had expired, and he was up for a renewal of his contract, and his contract was not renewed after he was warned to stop doing this repeatedly from the school district. So apparently the school district was concerned that the coach doing this, Mr. Kennedy doing this, Coach Kennedy doing this, constituted an endorsement of religion or an establishment of religion on the part of the school district. So the school district was concerned that by allowing the coach to do this, not prohibiting from doing this, it would essentially be construed by the public as the school district endorsing religion, endorsing Christianity. And they were scared off and they did not renew his contract, essentially terminated him. And that really was the beginning of this case. And this is how it went from federal district court again up through the appeals to the Supreme Court. There were some factual issues that needed to be resolved. It kind of bounced around and now has again up to the court, had oral arguments today. So the question, of course, was whether this constitutes an endorsement of religion.
And Mike, explain to my listeners here, what exactly does the First Amendment say, or the religious clause say? Because I've heard the old thing, Mike, it's an often misunderstood argument, freedom of religion versus freedom from a government religion. Talk about that.
Right, certainly. Now, let's talk about this again. In the First Amendment, you have enshrines a number of rights. Of course, we have these certain liberties, free speech, free exercise of religion, and it also prohibits establishment of religion. And so all these concepts, these liberties, are in tension with each other. And so they kind of come together in this sort of case. What line does a court draw? What line does our society draw where a state actor, in this case, I'm not going to dispute that he's not a state actor. He's a teacher. I mean, he's a coach. He's functioning as an employee of the state. But where does he get to exercise his right to free speech? And when does it cross a line into him acting as a state actor, establishing religion or endorsing religion? So establishing religion, there's a prohibition on a state establishing religion. Okay, now the court has construed that establishment of religion in a bunch of different contexts. In the context of a teacher, if they are engaging in coercive activity, in other words, they're saying, they're coming in, and there was a lot of hypothetical discussion of this in the court and oral arguments today. If you come in and you say, you're saying a prayer out loud in your instructional capacity, I'm an algebra teacher, the bell rings, and then right before I start teaching my algebra lesson, I say the Our Father. Mm-hmm. Well, and then so what will happen is students in my class, in eighth grade, ninth grade, might think, oh boy, in order for me to get in good with Mr. O'Neill, I see that he says a prayer every day. I might not believe in that prayer. I might not believe in the Our Father, but I'm going to say the Our Father because Mr. O'Neill says the Our Father every day before algebra class, right when algebra class starts. So I'm going to say that. Well, that crosses a line, I think. And I think reasonable people can say that might cross a line. But let's pull back here and let's look at let's distinguish what we're talking about in this case. In this case, you had a coach after the game, after his duties as coach, so he's not in that classroom hypothetical, the game is concluded, runs out to midfield and says a silent prayer for 15 seconds, giving thanks for getting through that game. And thank you, Lord, for I'm not specifically on exactly what his prayer was, but it was a silent 15 seconds prayer of thanksgiving after the game had concluded. I think reasonable people can look at that and say, doesn't really establish, there's no coercion there, and there's no establishment of religion there. I think it's okay.
I saw one of the coercion arguments, though, Mike, and our mm-hmm. guest is Mike O'Neill from Landmark Legal, that occasionally some players would go out there. There was a photo of him and players of both sure. teams. The game's over. And they're saying, well, that could be the coercion thing, Mike, that you explained in that algebra class analogy. Some people are saying, especially for teammates of both teams who don't feel comfortable doing that, you know, is coach going to look down on me because I don't do that?
Right, and that's a great question. And in fact, you know, I was just listening to oral arguments just before I came on, and there was a lot of talk about that from the justices. Justice Kagan was concerned about that. Justice Kavanaugh really engaged in a lot of hypotheticals about that. And again, I think here you're going to always have people who feel a certain way. What we have to do is the court has to draw a line here and say whether it constitutes, and incidentally, just from a legal standpoint, coercion wasn't really the specific issue that the school district was worried about in this. They were worried about the establishment issue or an endorsement relation, mm-hmm. an endorsement. But coercion's a good point. And I think you have to look at really the facts of this case. Is after the game 15 seconds of silent prayer? He's not doing this in a halftime speech. He wasn't doing this as a condition. For example, let's get in this. What if he's wearing a Pittsburgh Steelers hat?
Yeah.
And the kids are like, well, I'm not a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, but maybe if I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, coach will be more likely to like me and he'll be more likely to put me in. So really, you could kind of go down that coercion hypothetical as far as you want. But I think in this case, you have to look at exactly what the activity was. And incidentally, the record doesn't support that. The record doesn't say that there was any incidents where students felt coerced to do this. So I think that's really important to look at this case. But I think you raise a good point. If you have instances where there is more clear-cut coercion, I think that might be a more questionable case. But here you have, after the game, 15 seconds of silent prayer.
Any finally, Mike O'Neill, anything you could call from what you saw from the oral arguments today is, you know, this is a 6-3 majority. Are they going to rule for him or might there be some surprises?
Again, this is just, here we are, always spitballing this with that proviso. I think it's going to be for Coach Kennedy. I think that they're going to say, look, this does not constitute endorsement. This does not there was no evidence in the record of coercion. And if a coach, if an individual exercising in his personal capacity, again, he's not functioning as a coach, engages in a 15-second moment of or 15-second brief prayer after the conclusion of a game, it does not constitute an endorsement on the part of the school district by permitting that behavior.
As always, we thank you, Mike O'Neill, one of the staff attorneys there, Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. Mike, we'll follow this and we'll keep an eye on it. Thank you, sir.
Great being with you, Paul. You have a great day.
Thanks. Appreciate it. There's one of our legal eagles. We've got him on a national basis, locally too, from Quinnipiac and other law schools. That, though, Mike O'Neill from the, yes, conservative, right-leaning Landmark Legal Foundation. Check him out online at landmarklegal.org. So he thinks this is all going to come down to, was there any coercion involved here? Was it a case of, well, geez, you know, I'm not a religious guy or gal, but, you know, coach is doing it, so I better go do it. Interesting. We'll all find out about this and the other high-profile cases while the cars are running in June. You know, it's all they do in June, right? Here, this case is coming out, right? The abortion case is coming in June. And again, one of the biggest cases is this case out of New York City, where, and I think New York State, where officials in New York State, New York City, were purposely holding back concealed carry permits for gun owners and people that wanted to carry in New York City. Did they make it unreasonably difficult to get it? And now if the court throws that out in June, guess what? You know how many people in the city are going to be wanting gun permits with all the slime and the vermin right on the streets there? Are you kidding? With the subway problem? Yikes. Workers' unions, trade unions, unionism still a hot topic. A lot of people are either on one side of the fence, firmly for or against in this country, which at last look only had about 12 million or so people in unions, a far cry from decades ago when upwards of 40%+ of American workers were in unions. But are unions making a comeback? Our next guest has spent more than 20 years as a community and union organizer, working first in support of garment workers all around the world. My aunt was in a garment workers union, and then for U.S. labor unions organizing industrial laundry workers. The name of the book is On the Line, a story of class solidarity and two women's epic fight to build a union. Daisy Pitkin joins us. Hey, Daisy, it's Paul here on WICC. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Thank you. Very well, Daisy, and thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it. The book here, what made you, first of all, before we get into the actual nuts and bolts of this, what made you do this? Was it a love of labor organizing, your experiences out of and in unions? What drove you to put this together so people would want to read it?
So what drove me to write the book was, you know, I really wanted to tell a story about what it really takes to form a union in this country right now. All of the obstacles that a group of workers who've decided to organize because they'd like the opportunity to bargain for better wages and benefits and often health and safety inside their work sites. They want the opportunity to bargain those things with their employer collectively. And it's not an easy task to be able to get to that bargaining table. And I think at this moment, we're seeing a real upsurgence, a real groundswell of organizing. And there are lots of headlines about various kinds of worker movements and union organizing. And I wanted to give some context to those headlines. What does it really take? What does it look like behind the scenes on an organizing drive?
I would imagine, Daisy, before we get to more specifics in your book here and the characters, I would imagine that you were heartened at the vote that finally took place at that Amazon warehouse on Staten Island in New York.
Of course, yes. Congratulations to Amazon Labor Union and continued success to them. You know, their model of worker-to-worker organizing is really ambitious and bold. And I think the kind of the wave, the current wave that we're seeing now, and also the wave of the future, they're showing us the way right now.
All right, Daisy, hang on. We'll be right back. I'll do a quick break here. We're talking with the writer, longtime union organizer, Daisy Pitkin. Name of the book, On the Line, a story of class solidarity and two women's epic fight to build a union. Daisy, we'll get into that and more about the book. Coming up first, though, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And I'm sure in Ansonia and Shelton, Derby, Bridgeport, Fairfield, all over the state, there are either active union members or one-time union members. Hey, one of them's talking right here. I don't know whether my membership is over or it's on hold for like 20 years. Daisy Pitkin is the guest. The name of the book, On the Line, A Story of Class, Solidarity, and Two Women's Epic Fight to Build a Union. Now, Daisy, in this book, I know you talk about two people featured in the book, Daisy, of course, and Alma. And now set us up here, your experiences, Alma's, trying to get this union formed, the company. Give us a snapshot here of what you folks went through and what the book tells.
Great. So Alma works in an industrial laundry factory. And this is a kind of workplace that I think a lot of people don't know about, but they exist in every city and large community in this country. And they're big warehouses filled with heavy industrial machinery where workers work often around the clock, they're 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operations, to launder linens from hospitals, like in Alma's factory, or sometimes from the hospitality industry, so restaurants and hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And workers sort and wash and iron and fold. But mostly not, I mean, they sort by hand, but most of the work is done on big, heavy machinery. And health and safety is a huge issue in these factories. So Alma works in one of these factories in Phoenix, Arizona. And the book tells the story of me as a young organizer on my first union organizing campaign, being paired with her, kind of meeting her, and helping her to organize her coworkers when she and they decide that they want to form a union. Alma is really one of the gutsiest people I have ever met. I mean, she just has this kind of natural charisma and this steely disposition where she decided that forming a union was absolutely necessary, not only in her own factory, but in others of these factories across Phoenix and really across the whole state of Arizona. But it took years to organize them. And that's partly because labor law really is in a difficult spot right now. It's loopholed and broken. And, you know, employers, especially big corporations like the one that Alma worked for, are able to hire very expensive anti-union consultants that help the company kind of manipulate labor law and delay and even break labor law or violate labor law. And that all of those things happened in Alma's factory. So it took us about 5 years to organize the industry in Arizona. And the story is really just about Alma and her kind of deep commitment to building solidarity among these laundry workers. And it tells the story of the union that they built, mm-hmm. that they were able to build together with each other.
How old were you, Daisy, when this was going on? You had that moment. You said, hey, I want to get involved in this. How old were you, A? And B, was there ever a moment or how many moments did you have during this thing, Daisy, in no matter how much you were, you know, you thought the conviction was right, did you have moments of doubt? Did you say, geez, what in the heck am I doing here?
I never had a moment of doubt in that way about union organizing. I mean, I'm committed to this, the idea and the, frankly, the federal right that workers have to form unions so that collectively they can speak to their employers about things that they need in order to make their jobs safer and more sustainable. I'm really committed to that idea, and I always have been, right? Union organizing, though, as you'll know if you pick up a copy of my book and read it, it is not an easy job. It is difficult, and the pacing of it is kind of frenetic, and it's kind of all-consuming. So there were moments when I thought, what the heck am I doing in that regard?
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
The work, it's very hard. It's really hard work. But it's you know, some of the most important work I can imagine, because I think that really the way to change some of the things that are deeply wrong in the U.S. economy are by giving workers more power to speak up about things that are happening at their workplaces. And the only way right now to do that, the only avenue through which workers can sort of gain a little bit more control, a little bit more power at work, is through unions.
I would think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Daisy, and the author is Daisy Pitkin, name of the book On the Line, A Story of Class Solidarity and Two Women's Epic Fight to Build a Union. I know that when a union drive is underway, the national union will, I know, help you with legal advice, lawyers, some people. But beyond that, was there ever a moment or two or more when, you know, you were confronted by management at the company, either locally or nationally? Did you ever have one of those, hey, we like you, you shouldn't really be doing this? Talk a little about, because I know it happens practically everywhere, Daisy, talk a little about the pushback and the pressure, which I know sometimes can be scary. Were you ever scared at all in the process?
Well, I was not scared because I was a staff union organizer. It was my job to help workers form this union. I was not risking my job by organizing. Mm-hmm. Alma and her coworkers were. And though Alma never seemed for a moment to be afraid, many of her coworkers were frightened by the anti-union campaign run by the managers at her plant. They were threatened. They were surveilled. They were told that the plant might close. Alma and three of her coworkers were fired for a time and had to file charges in order to get their jobs back. And that scares people. You know, people don't work at industrial laundries, which are hot, dangerous places to work, unless they have to, mm-hmm. unless they need that money in order to live. They can't afford to lose their jobs. So this was not an easy choice for workers to decide that they wanted to unionize there, but that collectively they decided it was what they were going to do, and they did it despite years of union busting.
How this turned out, is the company still there? How's the union doing there? As you look back on this, what's it look like now versus the pre-union days?
So in most industrial laundries, when unions are formed, and a lot of industrial laundries in this country are union now, and Alma's factory is still union. So this was years ago, and she's actually retired now, so she doesn't work there anymore. But the union is still going strong inside that factory. It's also not owned by the same corporation it was. It's been sold to a couple of different corporations mm-hmm. in the years that followed. But, you know, in union laundries, one of the first things that happens after contract negotiations where you get to improve wages and benefits and access to benefits, one of the first things is that workers form a health and safety committee. Mm-hmm. And that committee gets trained by experts within the union. And also sometimes OSHA advisors can help to train workers to spot hazards, to understand sort of production pressure and how it makes things dangerous, to better understand the equipment that they work on and lockout, tagout procedures, to know where the safety guards are supposed to be and how they're supposed to operate so that they can spot if things are faulty or missing in the plant. So health and safety inside union laundries is a major concern, and it's one of the biggest and most important improvements that happens inside union laundries in comparison to non-union laundries, where workers can't form those committees. And those, you know, without the existence of those committees and the ability of workers to raise those issues, those plants continue to be pretty dangerous places to work.
Finally, and here's the tough question I have to ask you, Daisy. I know this is tough, but who's mm-hmm. gonna play you in the movie? Who would you like to play you in the movie?
I think the better question is, who's going to play Alma? That would be the much more exciting role to play, and I have no idea, but I hope it's someone as beautiful as she is. Inside and out, of course.
The name of the book is On the Line, A Story of Class, Solidarity, and Two Women's Epic Fight to Build a Union. A union organizer and now author, Daisy Pitkin, has been the guest. Daisy, thank you. Good luck, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thanks.
Yes, thanks so much. Have a good day.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. On the Line, A Story of Class, Solidarity, and Two Women's Epic Fight to Build a Union. Daisy Pitkin, the guest there. Who will play her in the movie? You know, I could see what movie was coming to mind during the middle of this thing. The movie with Sally Field. I forgot. What was the name of that movie where she was a factory organizer? I can't remember. All I can see is Sally Field there in the factory.